kind of change my view here so I can see everyone. That's better. Thank you. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
And what a beautiful morning it is here in Vancouver. I'm glad you decided to come and not hit the beach or go for a walk in the parks. But it is so beautiful. And this is the first talk of our practice period. We had a wonderful and I think very warm opening last night. It felt good to be doing this again, to be doing this in the Zendo and of course with the people on the Zoom as well. And I was thinking of last year, the theme was, of course, what was it, the person in the hut, the hermit in the hut, because that was our circumstances. We were all kind of isolated, more or less, not sure what was going on, and how do we be in that kind of place. And this time, at this moment, we're stepping out of the hut, hopefully, that we'll be looking at how do we then enter the world? How do we, again, develop our relationships with other people, with ourselves, as we enter the world in a different way than we have been for the past almost 2 years? And how do we relate to the world as a whole? So I'd like to begin my talk with a small piece of, well, I guess maybe it's a poem, or actually a song by Leonard Cohen. And this is an old one, I think. It goes back to the 90s, so maybe most of you don't know this one, but it's from the album that was called The Future. And the verse I want to read goes like this. Things are going to slide in all directions. Won't be nothing, won't be nothing you can measure anymore. The blizzard of the world has crossed the threshold and it's overturned the order of the soul. The blizzard of the world has crossed the threshold and it's overturned the soul. Now, if you have ever lived on the prairies or in the foothill region in Alberta, as I have, maybe you've experienced the winter blizzard. Of course, there's many other places in the world too, maybe you have. And that's when the falling and blowing snow is so thick you can't see more than a foot or two ahead. Farmers in the prairies had ropes that would link their house to the barn so that they could find their way home again after the animals were taken care of in the morning. And if not for those ropes, they may have wandered off in the wrong direction. And there are many stories in the prairies of where that happened. When I was growing up in Calgary, it was not uncommon for drivers to get caught in a blizzard. And they would die from the cold if they had not prepared for an emergency with extra blankets or some other way to keep warm while waiting out the snowstorm. I remember as a teenager, one time I was caught in a sudden snowstorm while delivering Chinese food, as I did for a part-time job. And I pulled over to what I hope was the curb, I couldn't really tell, and waited after checking to see if I had enough gas to keep warm in the car. So I could kind of start the car, turn on the heater, warm up the car, turn it off again. It was kind of a thing you'd learn to do in that kind of situation. And of course, this was a time long before cell phones. Cell phones were simply a Star Trek dream in those days. And fortunately, the blowing snow only lasted about 30 minutes. And I made it back to the restaurant fine to begin the next delivery. But the situation that we live in today reminds me of a blizzard. Surrounded by danger, isolated, unable to see clearly even a little ahead, and not knowing when things or how things will change. And this is a blizzard, not of snow, of course, but of perhaps economic disparity, injustice, ecological devastation, racial inequality, wars, and of course, the pandemic that we find ourselves in. The global competition for petroleum and other limited natural resources are factors in the decline of our natural habitat. And it brings our attention to the woundedness of this earth. And we see this woundedness very clearly, right? Today, in the blazing wildfires, some of them still happening in the States, unfortunately, the terrible storms that have hit various places in the world, floods, as we saw in Germany of all places, rising temperatures, the list goes on. And many have argued that the climate crisis we find ourselves in today is the result of our modern view of nature as being something other, right? Nature is something we control, something we do something to, as somehow out there. And I was thinking, you know, even the word environment reflects this in part. Because the word environment, in its most basic meaning, means that which surrounds us, indicating that it's somehow separate from us, right? It surrounds us, it's not us. It's out there. The entire global community has certainly felt this terrible impact of COVID-19. Again, for almost 2 years now, right? And this pandemic has radically altered, I believe, our view of ourselves, our family, our neighbors, strangers, both near and distant. This infectious virus has further spread and strengthened our sense of isolation, fear, mistrust, and anger, which was already pretty prevalent, before the COVID even hit us. Commentaries we can read in the newspapers or magazines or we hear on TV have spoken much about the strong polarization that's so evident, particularly in the United States, but more recently in other countries and certainly in ours as well. And in the Doksan room, I hear from people and from my friends a number of stories about the broken or wounded relationships over strongly held views around vaccination and the restrictions that are going on. And all of this that I've just talked about touches the woundedness within our own minds and our own hearts. Some of us hurting from old wounds, wounds from perhaps we receive from parents not ready for parenting, or parents who are unable to communicate their love and concern for us when we really needed it most. And we may carry the wounds of not having our affections returned in kind, of broken friendships, relationships, death of loved ones, many wounds. And the images and stories that we carry around on how and who we should be often don't match the person we feel we are. Living this disconnection, we become alienated within our own selves. But don't worry, I'm not going to go on with this. I know we each experience this blizzard in different ways. And at times, I think we all feel as if we're huddled in a cold car, waiting and praying for the weather to clear. So where do we find help? Where do we find solace? The Buddha is often called the great healer or physician, providing medicine and treatments to heal all. But this is not healing in the conventional sense. When we look at his life as described in the early texts, the early suttas, we soon discover that he became ill, perhaps from dysentery or something like that. He suffered the common pains from an aging body, and of course he died. The Buddha never spoke of going beyond the limits of the body and mind. But his essential sense of well-being was not restricted by the physical condition of his body and mind. He fully understood and accepted the nature of physical existence. Yes, we are subject to sickness, old age, and death. But he is known as the great healer, the great physician, because he offered a path of healing, a way to become whole in the very midst of the chaos of one's life. For example, maybe you've heard of the story of Kiso Gotami. She was a young woman at the time of the Buddha who married and gave birth to a son. And when disease struck her village, her young son became ill and died. And Kiso Gotami was distraught and could not accept what had happened. And she carried the body of her child from house to house, asking for medicine to cure her little boy. Time after time, people tried to tell her that her child was dead. But she could not believe them. And eventually, an old villager, seeing how grief had so upset her mind, told her this: "I cannot give you medicine, but I know a man who can. Go and see the Buddha." Kiso Gotami followed his advice, went before the Buddha, saying, "Please give me medicine to cure my son." And the Buddha replied, "I can cure your son if you can fetch me a mustard seed. But the mustard seed must come from a household in which no one has ever died." So Kiso Gotami again went around the nearest village, knocking on all the doors, asking for a mustard seed. And everyone who was willing to give her a mustard seed, but when she asked if anyone in the house had died, the reply was always the same: "Yes, of course, death has visited this house many times." And in this way, the truth began to dawn on Kiso Gotami. Death was everywhere. Every household had been touched by death. She was finally able to accept that her child had died. She performed the necessary rites for her child and then returned to where the Buddha was staying. She thanked the Buddha and asked to become a nun. And she was ordained, and according to the texts, became one of the most noted nuns within the Buddhist community. So the Buddha clearly did not cure the young child, but he healed Kisa Gotami. Now, to cure and to heal have two different etymologies. To cure comes from the Latin word curare, which was first introduced into the English language probably from France sometime in the 13th century, according to my research. And the Oxford English Dictionary says to cure means to take care of, to take charge of, or a successful medical treatment. On the other hand, to heal is a very old word in the English language and is closely related to our English word holy, as in something that's sacred, right? Both healing and the word holy derive from the same root, going back to an old Norse word, hela, which means to make whole, to make whole. So we could say that cure has a kind of limited objective, a kind of removal of some troublesome symptoms, right? And this difference between cure and heal, this is a little bit of a side bar, perhaps, to me illustrates one of the challenges within the contemporary mindfulness movement. But I don't want to imply that this is true for all the teachers who use mindfulness or in a therapeutic setting, but mindfulness is often suggested as a way to deal with certain symptoms. And once those symptoms are gone, the need for mindfulness is also gone. But let me hasten to add, this is also true for many people who come to Mountain Rain for the first time. Some people come because they are dealing with certain unpleasant or painful sensations in their lives, and they're seeking relief, which is very natural, right? Yeah, very natural. And the practices, perhaps with teachings and the Sangha, all help to bring relief from the challenging aspects of one's life. That's true. I remember Chosen, a woman who is one of the abbots of the Great Vow Monastery in Oregon, telling me that all too often, once a student had obtained some immediate relief from their stress or suffering, she or he would drift away from practice, because their life was now unfolding smoothly. But some of those students would then return to practice when again a challenging situation arose, perhaps in a relationship or a diagnosis or some other source of stress in their life. Kind of like yo-yo students, coming in for the dose and going back into life. I think this is an example of how practice sometimes is used as a kind of cure for that immediate symptom, rather than a form of healing. Healing, as we saw in its etymology, is to become whole. So what does it mean to become whole? Wholeness implies inclusion of everything. Inclusion of everything. To be whole is to be in relationship. In relationship to your heart and mind, in relationship to your body, in relationship to significant others, relationship to society, relationship to nature. Whole. This connection, this intimacy with everything. And if wholeness implies inclusion of everything, then to be whole as a person is to be whole amongst others and the world. So far, okay? Now the word relationship that I used and that we're using for this practice period came into English also around the 13th century, same as cure did. And it comes from the Latin word relatio, which means connection. So to put it another way, wholeness or healing is to be connected to our hearts, minds, connected to our bodies, to be connected to our significant others, connected to society, connected to nature, etc. So looked at, I think, from this perspective, healing or relationship is at the center of the Buddhist teachings. The first teaching of the Buddha, which we call the Four Noble Truths, is often given a kind of medical analogy. And it kind of goes, a medical analogy of like examination, diagnosis, prescription, and treatment. And this isn't just something that was thought up by, say, contemporary teachers. This appears in some of the earliest Buddhist writings. They saw this as a very important analogy. Now, there are some variations on how this works, but the first noble truth is, first of all, to observe the condition, right? To acknowledge and look at the nature of our dukkha, that Sanskrit word meaning discontent, dissatisfaction, suffering in one's life. And you go to the doctor, and the doctor, okay, where does it hurt? What does it feel like? How long has it been going on for? Right? We look closely at the nature of our suffering. The second noble truth is the diagnosis of the cause. What causes this? What's the underlying condition or the origin of our dukkha, of our great suffering? And the noble truth says the cause is ignorance, that everything is impermanent and interrelated nature of all reality. That we are blind to that, right? And this fundamental ignorance that we have gives rise to confusion, greed, hatred, those kind of afflictive emotions that we have. But please don't worry, guys. Don't get upset, because the prognosis is good. Dukkha is not terminal. The third noble truth states that the cessation of dukkha is possible if we follow the treatment plan, if we follow the prescription, which is given in the fourth noble truth as the Eightfold Path. Traditionally given as, of course, right views, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Now, we're not going to look at these right now, but I do want to say the word right is a translation of the Pali word samma. And samma implies right in the sense that it works, that something is wholesome and not harmful. So the title for this practice period, as you all know, is Right Relationship, Healing and Nurturing Connection. And we use this word, right, in the same sense as the samma, something that is wholesome. Not distorted or harmful. Maybe another word may be upright, not twisted or bent. An upright relationship. So how do we move from where we are? How do we move from isolation or hurtful relationships into an upright relationship? Relationships that are wholesome, whole. Maybe we could say that relationships that are holy, H-O-L-Y. I think you all understand that the wholeness that the Buddha pointed to does not mean perfection. Rather, the wholeness that the Buddha points to means embracing brokenness as simply an integral part of life. Dogen Zenji, the Japanese priest who brought this form of practice from China to Japan way back in the 1200s, he wrote this: flowers fall even though we love them, and weeds spread even though we hate them. This is the nature of our human life. Flowers and weeds. Flowers and weeds. What relationship do you have to the flowers of your life? And what relationship do you have with the weeds of your life? Appreciating the flowers, taking joy in them, celebrating them, does not lead to dukkha. Struggling to keep flowers at the center of your life, to preserve them at all costs, and constantly seek after them, that does lead to dukkha. And as we know, pushing away the weeds, ignoring them, judging them, hating them, well, that too leads us directly into dukkha. Our flowers will always fall. Weeds will always appear. And over the next weeks, we will talk about some of the qualities of right relationship. But one of the key qualities I'd like to mention right now is equanimity. When pushed and pulled by desires and aversion, we can no longer be in a right relationship, an upright relationship to ourselves, to those around us, to the world, because we just respond to how we want things to be, how we wish them to be, rather than how they are. Equanimity fades away. And without equanimity, there can be no clarity. Relationships become dull and confused. Our life becomes stale and unstable. We need equanimity as one of the qualities of upright relationship. Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, is usually enshrined in the Zendo. We don't have him here in our Zendo, but certainly when you go to larger temples or monasteries, you'll see Manjushri there sitting usually on the altar inside the Zendo. And he, in one hand, he holds a sword to cut off delusions, old ideas, patterns that we have, we're kind of stuck in, right? That's the symbol of the sword. And he keeps cutting. Chop, chop, chop. Until there is just openness to what is. Which is another way of saying, perhaps, upright or right relationship. Open to what is. Often Manjushri is depicted riding on a lion. And this lion represents fearlessness or equanimity. Without some equanimity, we cannot cut through our confusion. And without equanimity, right relationship remains elusive. Now, I started this talk with part of a song written by Leonard Cohen. The blizzard of the world has crossed the threshold, and it's overturned the order of the soul. And I gave a brief description of the blizzard, right, swirling around us today. The blizzard that overturns the soul, leaving us disconnected, lonely, unstable. And I wonder, what is the blizzard like for you? What is it like for you, this moment of your life? In so many ways, so many of us have fallen out of right relationship with our bodies, with our hearts and minds, our families, our friends, our community, nature. But let's not make the mistake that right relationship is a cure, a goal to be met. I think that would be starting off on the wrong foot. We cannot write down in 6 or 8 points the steps that will lead us into right relationship. You know, self-help books, you see, you know, the 6 of this, the 5 of that, the 10 of this. I don't think that's very helpful for right relationship. There is no recipe. Nor can we really master a right relationship in a weekend workshop. So sorry to tell you, you'll have to do a little more work than just come for these 2 days. Right relationship is alive, flowing and changing like everything else. And as it is alive, we need to be attentive to it, to nurture it, to dance with it. And over the next weeks of practice period, let's together explore some of the qualities of right relationship. Let's consider applying our practice again and again and again into entering right relationship. We need to tend to it, so that we may respond each moment with the fullness of our bodhisattva vows. So together, let's consider how to heal, become whole, our various relationships again. I said, you know, our various relationships. And then I began to wonder after I wrote this, well, how many relationships do I have? You know, I listed those kind of ones that seemed kind of obvious to me at the beginning. And then something occurred to me. I think you have all heard, at least I hope you had, the beautiful indigenous blessing, all my relations. All my relations. And here is how the Ojibwe writer Richard Wagamese explains this blessing. And in his words, I think we discover the boundlessness, this boundless net of relationships that hold us and that we need to tend to. So here's his words, Richard Wagamese. All my relations is to come to understand that you are alive because everything else is. It means everything. It is not uttered in a casual way, nor is it meant to be. In its solemnity, it is meant as a benediction, a blessing, a call to this unity you feel all around you in the depth of a morning. This phrase, this articulation of spirit, is a clarion call to consciousness. It means that you recognize everything as alive and elemental to your being. There is nothing that matters less than anything else. By virtue of its being, all things are vital, necessary, and a part of the grand whole, because unity cannot exist where exclusion is allowed to happen. This is the great teaching of this statement. All my relations means all. When a speaker makes this statement, it is meant as a recognition of the principles of harmony, unity, and equality. It is a way of saying that you recognize your place in the universe, and that you recognize the place of others and of all things in the realm of the real and the living. In that, it is a powerful evocation of truth. Upright relationship. I think as the great now departed teacher Richard Wagamese writes, it is the truth of our life. Our life, when we look really closely, is nothing but relationship. So for this practice period, we'll tease apart a few threads. That's all we'll have time for. But our practice is really embracing this great net of relationships, nurturing it, delighting in it. And in this way, I think we will enter deeper into the wholeness that we are. Thank you for listening.
Page 3 of your chapter.